Greetings and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. Today we have on the show with us Dr. Thomas E. Woodward, who is a professor at Trinity College in Florida with a PhD in rhetoric of science from the University of South Florida. Dr. Woodward is the founder and director of the C.S. Lewis Society, and he lectures regularly in universities and on campuses on topics related to intelligent design and Darwinian evolution. He's the author of the books Doubts About Darwin and Darwin Strikes Back, and he's a very well-known author for those who follow ID literature. Today we're going to talk to Dr. Woodward about his new book with medical doctor James P. Gill titled The Mysterious Epigenome, What Lies Beyond DNA. So, Dr. Woodward, thank you so much for coming on ID the Future.
It's great to be with you again.
Well, we had you on a couple times before talking about some of your previous books, and your new book, you were right on the cutting edge of the science of the debate over Darwinian evolution here with your new book, The Mysterious Epigenome, looking at the new discoveries in biology that are showing that the old dogma that DNA makes RNA makes protein, it's true, but it's only a small part of the story, and there's actually a lot more going on in biology. So as we tell the story of your book and get into this topic, I'd like to tell the story in a similar way to how you tell it in the book, starting with the Human Genome Project, as you recount in the book. What did the Human Genome Project tell us about biology, which hinted that there's a lot more going on than just DNA makes RNA makes proteins in cells?
Well, the Human Genome Project, which of course really began to rev up to full speed in the early 1990s, and this is just when I began teaching here at Trinity College of Florida. And I was following that with great interest. Originally, Dr. Watson, the famous Watson and Crick duo that explored and finally elucidated the double helix structure of DNA back in the 50s. Well, he was one of the early heads, and then it was handed off to Francis Collins, which I think most of the listeners of this podcast have followed his career to some extent. And there was a great hype, and maybe I should just say hope and expectation, of the results, which of course came out in a preliminary form in 2000, the Human Genome Project had its first draft then, and then about 3 or 4 years later, the final draft was published. But there was a hope of really conquering many of the human diseases and maladies through a better understanding of the readout, the ATCGs of the human entire 3.1 gigabyte hard drive of the human genome. And it was, of course, a great medical breakthrough, great biological breakthrough to get that complete readout of the genome. But the hope that we had been presented earlier on in the early 90s just didn't pan out. There was very little. As a matter of fact, the story that was published in the New York Times said that there was virtually no results, significant, you know, gene therapy results. And, of course, there was something of a letdown, but then what had happened, meanwhile, is that the hard drive of DNA, it's sometimes described, has a software, literally a software that directs the activity of the genome, and that epigenome, the newly discovered continent of information within the cell, that was seen to have this incredibly important role as the director of the genome orchestra. So that is really the exciting discovery. As we wrote about it, Dr. Gills and I wrote about it, we discovered this incredible layer upon layer upon layer of additional information that he and I didn't even glimpse, oh, maybe 15 years ago or even 10 years ago. So that's the exciting news, and it's been fun to watch it and to write about it.
That's fascinating, Dr. Woodward. I remember the findings of the Human Genome Project, that our genome only has about, say, 25,000 genes, which is, of course, about the same order of magnitude as you might find in a fruit fly. And so what exactly is causing the differences between these very diverse organisms? I would like to think that we're more complex than a fruit fly. So where are those differences encoded? And epigenetics is now turning out to be the answer to a lot of those questions. So how, and you maybe already hinted at this a little bit, but how is epigenetics a revolution in the way we understand the cell?
Well, I think it's properly termed, even by many biological scientists themselves, a revolution in that we now understand, science has learned, especially in the last 10 or 12 years, that the histone code is extremely important to understand how DNA functions, how it's read, how it's copied, how it's shut down. And the histone code is one layer that we really tried to show in our book and actually kind of employed a bit of creativity with that bubble submarine trip in the cell. But the histone code is a series of three small signals or three small chemical attachments to the tails are actually eight tails that stick out from the spool, the histone spool, where DNA is wound up on. There's about 30 million of them in a typical nucleus. And these histone spools have like landing strips. These tails are like landing strips for special little chemical markers, and there are sockets built into the side of those tails. And as the various acetyl or phosphor or methyl tanks are added, it sends signals both to the DNA control system and to several other molecular systems residing in or near the nucleus. And then DNA is then locked down. It's like a filing cabinet that's locked or it's opened up. It's sometimes primed for special kinds of activities. It's amazing that this code sat right beside the DNA code, and science never knew it existed until, let's say, 15 years ago. And then, of course, then there's the methyl code. Methyl tags are attached directly to DNA and especially the promoter regions of genes. We didn't know much about that until the last 15 years. And then we find information inscribed even on the cell membrane and some of the structures in the cell. And, of course, the zygote code is one that is staggering most of all, is the fertilized egg has its own form of code system built into it. So we like to think of it, information is inscribed everywhere you look, at some level at least.
Well, Dr. Woodward, you just answered the next question I wanted to ask, which is, tell us about some of the information that's beyond the DNA. One other example that you mentioned in your book, The Mysterious Epigenome, is the splicing code. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about what the splicing code is?
Well, I'm not an expert, but I've been reading pretty much in-depth technical articles as well as review papers on this for the last 4 years. And the splicing code is really a set of signals, and it could be methylation, it could be informational signals embedded in those little spacers, the so-called introns that are cut out of a spliced piece of messenger RNA. But the splicing code enables a cell to do a mix and match of the pieces of a gene. In our book, we compare it to a super recipe. Imagine a really, really brilliant chef who's produced on one sheet of paper a recipe with different elements. And within that recipe sheet are the signals to vary what you add, whether you leave out the butter or include it, whether you add, let's say, a stick of cinnamon or not, whether you include 3 cups of flour and a cup of some other grain or just the 3 cups of flour. And so if you can produce 35,000 dishes from one recipe, you have a kind of a glimpse of this splicing code that enables a single gene in a fruit fly to produce 35,000 different proteins, depending on how those pieces are spliced together. And so it expands manyfold the information content that can be derived from those genes, what you mentioned a moment ago, the 20,000 plus genes. And so it opens up another universe, a miniature universe of information that can expand out of a single gene.
So this is actually part of the answer to why our genomes contain supposedly so few genes, is that there really is the potential there for a lot more diversity of proteins. And of course, all of the splicing code and all of these mixing and matching of domains and parts within the genome, that's all being mediated by the epigenome. And so it's a lot more complex than I think folks usually thought. One of the more interesting aspects of the epigenetic revolution is how health-focused it has become. For example, Dr. Woodward, there was recently a news article that talked about how working out for an hour at the gym can turn certain genes on and off in your cells that affect your metabolism and your health. So what does this tell us about epigenetics, and how is this epigenetic revolution health-focused in many ways?
Well, to me, that's like the headline of our study, is that the more deeply we peered into this, the layer upon layer, and what they're doing, these epigenetic signals, the tags and flags by the millions that are arrayed across the cellular material. We found that you can, as you said, you can actually turn genes on that were asleep, that were, if you will, methylated. They had these methyl tags attached to them so that they were in a state of anesthesia. And then when a person works out intensely at a gym who hadn't been working out, then all of a sudden, the 5 genes are awakened, they're put in action, and they begin to bump that cell, that muscle cell, to a new level or a new kind of metabolism activity. And this was a shock because scientists knew that you could, through health habits, reset those codes, those epigenetic codes. And we write a lot about that in our book, in the first chapter and the later chapters as well. But what we didn't realize is how supple, how plastic and how sensitive those codes are to even activities day to day. And so we're learning that those changes can not only cut down lifespans. One report said you could cut 32 years off a lifespan by binging. Young boys binging on the farms in northern Sweden. But by the same token, proper care of our bodies and good health habits can retweak or reset those codes, and that can be passed on as a legacy to the next generation. There's good evidence accumulating for that. So we're talking about a whole new tunnel or a kind of portal, an entryway into the health issues that we are also interested in.
Now, Dr. Woodward, I understand that you've had some opportunities to present this material on a number of university campuses. In fact, you recently presented at Dartmouth University, and apparently some members of the biology department came, and you guys had a good discussion. What has been the reception to your book and your conversations about the epigenetic revolution?
Well, that has been really gratifying. My first sojourn is I was able to present this at a very elite medical university in Lima, Peru. Cayetano Heredia is the number one medical biological research university in Peru. And at that Lima University, the auditorium was packed. We had about five professors. These are senior professors, a member of the faculty who was the president of the National Academy of Science of Peru was there. At another talk in which I discussed these issues of three, either presidents or former presidents, the National Academies of Science and Medicine were present. And as we discussed the evidence for irreducible complexity within different systems of the epigenetic marking and removal of marks, they were interested. They were not necessarily accepting everything I presented, but there was a good interaction. There was good overview of this whole area with the Peruvian students. And then when I presented at Dartmouth just a few weeks ago, I was delighted that about a dozen members of the biology department came out, and we had a wonderful conversation. I presented a lot of the newest research related to cancer, the involvement of epigenetics in cancer and aging, some of these health issues. And when I presented the problems, the three levels or three layers of problematic findings that we have that impinge on Darwinism, they were respectful. They didn't necessarily agree with any particular point I made, but the Q&A was among the best and the liveliest I've had in 28 years of lecturing on these issues. And so I really applaud those students. I chatted with three professors afterwards at Dartmouth. It was a really delightful time, and just really good scientific thinking is taking place. And I'm thankful for that.
Well, Dr. Woodward, this is obviously one of the most important questions I could ask you. But what are the implications of this epigenetic revolution for the debate over Darwinian evolution and intelligent design? What is this telling us about origins questions?
Let me mention two things. Number one, the neo-Darwinism mechanism, the mutation selection mechanism, which is so highly touted by, let's say, Richard Dawkins and Jerry Coyne, University of Chicago, and others who are classic neo-Darwinists, that theoretical structure is under great stress already from some of the empirical findings of Ralph Silke and Doug Axe, and even the work going on in these 40,000 generation experiments that we've been seeing up in Michigan. But what I think is really coming to light is that you cannot focus just on DNA. You have to account for the changes and the orchestration signals that are coming from epigenetics, the methyl tagging and the histone tagging and all the other levels of information embedded in a cell. Those are aspects of cellular life that have to be accounted for in any macroevolutionary theory, and they haven't in the neo-Darwinian synthesis. That area is completely unaccounted for and has to be by any robust theory. Secondly, any one of the acetyl tagging systems or the phosphorylation tagging systems or the methylation systems, these systems that precisely place and then remove when needed those tags, and maintain the tagging during cell division, all of those systems involve a whole fleet of protein machines to attach and remove and maintain the methyl tagging, for example. And it's hard to conceive of any undirected process that could piecemeal, step by step, create this irreducibly complex epigenetic system. I find that irreducible complexity is everywhere in these systems, and I asked Dr. Behe about that, Michael Behe, in our recent conference, and he said he does not disagree. He thinks that we've opened up a whole new realm of irreducible complexity in the epigenetic control system. So that was pretty exciting, and I think it remains a very intense discussion point among all the scientists interested in this area.
I very much agree with what you're saying. And when you think about the whole junk DNA mindset, what the epigenetic revolution is showing us is not only is this non-coding DNA functional, so it's not junk, but it's incredibly complex. We're discovering new layers of code and information, and these codes and these molecules that are produced by the non-coding DNA, these all interact to produce complex protein machines and RNA machines and machines that are made of mixtures of proteins and RNA, and they go out and interact in the cell and form new levels and new layers of complexity that I think an ID paradigm would have anticipated, but up to this point, nobody else really had. So my sense is that the epigenetic revolution is something that would have been totally anticipated under an ID-based paradigm of biology, whereas a Darwinian paradigm of biology would have been stuck in the central dogma of it's only DNA makes RNA makes protein, and if it's not making RNA, then it must be junk. And that's basically the way they would have looked at the world. And if we were stuck in that paradigm, I think biology would be very far behind where it is today. So, Dr. Woodward, one last question here, just to give our listeners an understanding of maybe where things are headed. What is the latest on DNA and RNA, and where is this field of epigenetics going?
The chapter that I had the most fun writing in our book was the next to last. It's chapter 11, and it's basically, let's look back at DNA. In our book, we're moving beyond DNA. We're looking at the control system that operates, that expresses or shuts down the expression of genes. But when you look back in DNA, the explosion of new information there is just fantastic. And I really kind of exalt the hero of RNA, because so many species of different kinds of RNA, functional RNA, beyond the messenger or beyond the transfer RNA, beyond the ribosomal RNA that forms the shell of a ribosome, we've now discovered all kinds of short and medium-sized snippets of RNA that are acting like team captains, that are acting like air traffic controllers, that are acting like scaffolding pieces on which other parts can be assembled. And when we look at the operation of pseudogenes, we have a two-page sidebar. I mean, it's just fascinating, and really unparalleled excitement is coming out of the study of functional pseudogenes. So those were a lot of my most exciting moments of research and writing. I would say epigenetics is just at the beginning stages of blossoming. One scientist says we can look forward to epigenetics opening up, starting now, like DNA began to take off in 1953 when the double helix structure was finally discovered. And so that's how early it is in the epigenetics revolution. I cannot wait to see what comes.
Well, Dr. Woodward, we really appreciate your coming on the show today to talk about your new book, The Mysterious Epigenome, What Lies Beyond DNA, again by both you and Dr. James P. Gill. It's a wonderful introduction to the topic of epigenetics and has a lot of interesting discussions about the implications for intelligent design and Darwinian evolution and health and lots of other larger philosophical questions. So, Dr. Woodward, we appreciate you being on the show, and thanks for the great work you're doing to get the message out on these issues.
And thank you, Casey, for giving me the chance. Thank you.
And of course, you can find more about the mysterious epigenome on Dr. Woodward's website, which is apologetics.org. And of course, you can also find it on amazon.com. I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.